What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I'm your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I speak with Jim Horacek. Jim was an officer with the CIA for many years. He had a front row seat to Iraq and our involvement there. And in particular, he witnessed firsthand the rise and fall of Zarqawi. We spoke for about an hour, and now I give you Jim Horacek. Okay, I'm here with Jim Horacek. Jim, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's my pleasure, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm very excited to talk with you, Jim, for a number of reasons. I want to discuss, obviously, you and your various brushes with history, 9/11 included. But before we get into all that, please tell our listeners that might not be familiar with you kind of who you are and what you're doing now.
Sure. So I was in the Central Intelligence Agency as an analyst, instructor, and supervisor for 15 years, from 1999 to 2014. My last 3 years were at U.S. Strategic Command in Omaha, Nebraska. I had some family ties to the area. I really liked living here, so got out of the agency rather than going back to Washington, D.C. for another 18 years. And after working at a local health system, which I never thought I would do that, I'm now back at U.S. Strategic Command, where I work in the Plans and Policy Division doing war game. So taking some of the analytic experience that I had and applying that to games to help the command to, you know, be thinking about some of the strategic issues that they might be involved with, particularly regarding nuclear weapons. So
yeah,
it's kind of a fun gig.
That's great. Yeah, that's fascinating. That was one of the things I wanted to ask you. So that actually is a perfect springboard. When you're building out a war game, first, maybe for our listeners that might not be familiar and haven't seen Top Gun.
You're one of the few.
I know, right? How would you define what a war game is, and how do you actually build out a war game scenario?
Sure. There are different ways that you can do it. The games tend to be different from an exercise, if you would think about that. An exercise is designed, and the command has those as well, obviously. The exercise is really designed to kind of, are you able to generate the forces that you need, and can you practice doing so? A game is more of a thought process. It's more for leadership to be thinking through decision-making and to identify areas that they're going to have to be cognizant of in the future. So we tend to take realistic, real-world scenarios with our strategic adversaries, and it's basically look at who has nuclear weapons and you know who that is, and then try to put it into, get the decision-makers into a place where they might be forced to make decisions about how to respond or how to utilize the weapons that we have in our arsenal. So generally, it's almost like role-playing. It's almost, if you're a Dungeons & Dragons fan or something like that, it's kind of like that, where we set up the scenario and we give them guidance and we say go. And then they will, you know, come up with courses of action that they'll submit. And then generally we have a red team full of adversary experts that will say, well, here's how we would think the adversary would respond to that action. And depending on how many moves you want to go, we can keep rolling with that, or we can just do move and then response and then talk about it. So various ways that we can do that. It could be anything from just a few hours or to a whole week.
Wow. Fascinating. Very cool. Just to wind the clock back there, Jim, I'd love to go back to the training days. What's training for the CIA like? First off, let's make it a two-parter. So what guided your decision to want to join the CIA? And then, yes, what was the training like for you?
Sure. So my academic background was all in the former Soviet Union. I grew up in Los Angeles, and when I was 16, my high school had an exchange where we could go to what was still the Soviet Union. It was 1990. Mm-hmm. Dates me a little bit, but... And my dad actually encouraged me to go. He was an Air Guardsman, kind of a Cold Warrior, and he kind of wanted to go too. That was kind of his thing. He's like, I'll go as a chaperone if you go. And so we went on, over Easter break, we went on, I think it was 10 days, And we went to what was then Leningrad, Moscow. And then for some reason, we went to Uzbekistan, to Samarkand and Tashkent, and instead of going to Kiev or Minsk or some of the European cities. And for this 16-year-old Southern Californian, you know, Central Asia was this whole brand new world that I knew nothing about. And said, this is amazing. I want to learn more about this. And then, of course, a year later, the Soviet Union collapsed entirely. And I just found all those various ethnicities, you know, that had decades and centuries long gripes against each other that were now playing out in the open. I found that to be fascinating. So I kind of studied that. That was my focus in undergraduate at the University of California, San Diego, and then went to George Washington University in DC with an idea of getting a government job at some point, and actually interned at the State Department in their Office of Financial Assistance to the newly independent states. So the guys that were giving these countries like Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan and others money to help build democracy, which didn't really work too well. And that actually turned me off kind of actually from working with State Department, because it's quite obvious that their policy wasn't working, but they were very wedded to it. And it was kind of like, well, why don't you change course? Well, it's because Congress has given us money to do this. So we're going to just carry it out and do it to the best of our ability. And that didn't really stick with me. And then when there was a job fair my second year, my last year of my master's degree at George Washington, there was a job fair where all of the intelligence community was there, including the CIA. And so I went up to them and I said, hey, do you have any use for a Russian speaker who knows about ethnic conflict in the former Soviet Union? They're like, yes, we do. So I gave them my resume, and I never actually formally applied. They took my resume. About a week later, they were back on campus and they interviewed me, and I got a conditional offer of employment, which was if you pass your security clearance background check, we'll hire you. So, and that was in May. I graduated not too long after that. And by October, they had hired, my clearance came through and I got hired. And you know, what drew me to the agency was because we were told to be apolitical, to not be wedded to policy, be the phrase that they like to use was, we're the skunk in the garden party. We're the guys that aren't afraid to tell the administration when things aren't going well. And, you know, and I really like that to just be able to say, you know, on the wall, it's the entrance to CIA headquarters. It's a quote from the Gospel of John, and it's, you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. And I thought that was really cool. You know, it's like we're committed to the truth, and that's what we're supposed to be doing. Now you can debate whether the CIA actually does that or not, especially nowadays. But that's what really drew me to being a part of that. And so my first job was working in Caucasus Central Asia, the non-Russian republics, and it was really interesting. At the time there was a three-day orientation. Just kind of get you used to the agency and set up your healthcare and all that stuff that like a normal business would do.
Right.
And on the last day, I was driving home. I heard on the radio that some gunmen had gone in and shot up the Armenian parliament. They had killed the speaker and the prime minister.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, that's interesting. I wonder if that'll affect me. Because they hadn't told me where, they told me I was going to be in the Office of Russian European Analysis, but they didn't tell me where. And so I was like, well, is that going to affect me? Well, the next morning I report to HR. They walk me down to my new team. They're in the middle of their morning meeting, and everybody starts laughing when I walk in the room. And I said, what's up, guys? And they're like, well, you're the new Armenia analyst. And they said nothing ever happened in Armenia before yesterday, so we were going to put the new guy on Armenia. And so you're the guy, you know, so. And I had a really great branch chief who's like, you know, as much about Armenia as we do, so you might as well just kind of run with this story. Let's let this be the first thing.
Yeah.
And so I think it was my third day in the office. I actually ended up, we had a question from President Clinton at the time asking what's going on with the shooting. And so my boss is like, you know, as much as you do, you might as well write the piece. So I ended up writing for the president on my third day in the office.
Wow.
And I was like, yeah, wow, this is awesome. You know, I'm in CIA. I'm writing for the president. All right. This is great.
What year was that, Jim? Sorry. To
1999.
Jump in.
Yeah. Okay. October of 99. So I'm thinking this is going to be, well, after that, Armenia kind of quiet down again, you know? So by the time September 11th rolled around, I was looking for something a little bit more exciting to do. When the second Intifada in Palestine started in 2000, there was actually a task force that stood up, and I volunteered to work on that. And so I was on the night shift, and my job was literally to count how many Palestinians were killed every night on my shift. and report that. And it was funny because the number of Palestinians being killed didn't go down, but the administration's interest in it went down, and they soon kind of killed the task force because they're like, this is just the new normal now, so we'll just handle this like it's a normal thing. But that kind of whetted my appetite for doing something a little bit more exciting, which is how I ended up in the Office of Terrorism Analysis after 9/11. Before that, to answer your other question, what kind of training do we get?
Yes, sir.
That's a great question because, I mean, CIA is seen as being a little elitist in the analytic world because there are analysts all over in all the three-letter agencies. But I think that's because we really do get the best training. We went through a new analyst course that nowadays it's about 4 months long. Then it was a little shorter, but they really did drill into what we call tradecraft. And there are different forms of tradecraft in the CIA. There's the spy stuff that you think about, but then there's also analytic tradecraft. And that's just how to think, how to question, how to think critically, how to question your sources, how to get more information from your sources, how to drive what we call driving collection, how to identify your potential biases and overcome them. And there are different tools and techniques that were involved in that.
Is that, so identify, when you say identify your biases, is it the biases within yourself or biases within the organization that you're analyzing?
It can be both. One of the biggest biases that you tend to see is something called mirror imaging. And that's where you as an American citizen impose kind of your worldview on someone not from the United States. So that would be, you know, a great example nowadays is saying, well, why is Putin doing all of this stuff in Ukraine? You know, he must be crazy.
Right.
Well, you know, that's coming. You know, why is he doing this when he's risking so much? You know, and that's kind of coming from an American perspective. But if you try to put yourself into Putin's perspective, he's a very rational actor. This all makes complete sense to him, what he's doing. And, you know, so that was some of the training was don't think like an American, think like the person that you're following. And that would then kind of help to explain what they were doing.
Interesting. So yeah, it's the idea that you're going to come into it with the sort of American exceptionalist mindset, and then that you're going to then map that onto something that you ought not to map it onto, like Putin or let's say Pakistan or Palestine, et cetera.
Huh. Another great example from that was something I was closely involved with was in the run up to Operation Iraqi Freedom. Of course, there was kind of a two-pronged approach that the administration was taking to justifying going into Iraq. There was the terrorism side, which I was involved with, mm-hmm. and then there was the weapons of mass destruction side. And I end up a few years later being instructor with a really good friend of mine now, who is the lead biology analyst looking at Iraq. So looking at their biological weapons or potential biological
weapons.
Wow. And she tells a great story in a lot of our classes about how the case that they made. So it was pretty solid. I mean, it was, we had human intelligence indicating that they had biological weapons. And you mirror that up with imagery showing a bunker with, you know, barbed wire perimeter guards, armed convoys going in and out periodically. And to the Western mind, that's a potential WMD storage facility, right? Because
sure.
That makes sense. Why else would you put that kind of burden? But then after, when we invaded and we did site exploitation on that site, where we actually went and visited the site, it turned out it was a food storage warehouse.
Hmm.
Because in Iraq at the time, food was a currency. It was a Sunni government, Saddam Hussein government, minority Sunni population in Iraq, governing the majority Shia population. And one of the ways they used that to maintain their power and to keep the majority down was food distribution. And that's why the administration had put so much emphasis on protecting that area. We, you know, to the Western mindset, that didn't make sense, right?
Right.
But the Iraqi mindset, it makes complete sense, obviously, in retrospect.
Oh, extraordinary. So, yeah, I would love to talk through, Jim, what then your experience on 9/11 was and how it impacted your career. Would you run through that for us?
Sure, certainly. So I was actually on vacation in Salt Lake City visiting friends. We were due to fly out that day, actually go back to Northern Virginia, my wife and I, and my daughter, who was about to turn one. And the friends we were staying with, her husband woke us up and said, you guys aren't going anywhere. Two planes just flew into the Twin Towers. They think it's terrorism. And then we watched the plane fly into the Pentagon and then watched the towers collapse. It was interesting because I immediately tried to call back to my boss in DC to check in. Phones weren't working, all that sort of stuff. We ended up being grounded. I think it was another 5 days, I want to say. And my daughter ended up actually spending her first birthday in Salt Lake with our friends unexpectedly. Mm. And by the time we finally got back to DC, of course, everybody was highly motivated to work against this target. One of the last things I did on my Armenia-Azerbaijan account was I wrote a little piece saying that both Armenia and Azerbaijan had pledged to assistance to the United States to in whatever they need, including overflight, permission, that sort of stuff. And then it was at that point that they put out a call for volunteers to go to the newly created Office of Terrorism Analysis. So prior to 9/11, there was the Counterterrorism Center within the CIA. And that had been set up in the mid-80s, mainly to deal with Palestinian groups, Hezbollah, PLO. And so set up during the Reagan administration. Had then in the 90s started to switch over to following bin Laden and the burgeoning Al-Qaeda and the attacks against the coal and Khobar Towers and things like that. But supporting that, there was a unit of about 40 analysts. But it was mainly an operations cell. So it was mainly the, now it's called the National Clandestine Service, but we called the Director of Operations back then, the operations guys. It was mainly their center, but they had analytic support there, which was kind of unusual in the rest of the agency. The rest of the agency, particularly where I worked, was still operating kind of under that Cold War mindset.
Yeah.
Where the analysts and the operations guys were separate from each other. And it was really interesting in my team because we all sat in the same vault. And so we got to know like the ops guys, but as soon as like we'd start talking about something substantive, a reports officer would come running out of their office and go, you can't talk to them about that. You have to talk to me. And I'm like, but we work, right? We're here. I know this guy, they're like, nope, can't top ops with them. We're the liaison. We're the reports officers. You talk to us. The case management officers is what they called it. They were the guys that took the information that the ops guys got and then published it. And then the analysts would then use that information. So it was deeply divided, but CTC didn't operate that way. The CTC was one of the few groups at the time that had the analysts directly supporting operations and mainly through targeting and which is identifying. Targeting can be used in many different ways. We think of it as going and like catching the bad guy or killing the bad guy. Targeting in the traditional sense is identifying ways to get information about a particular target. So who are those in the circle of influence that might have information there? And that's a kind of an analytic thing to do to identify who those people might be. And so that's what that group was doing. But so there's 40 on September 10th. Mm. And then literally overnight, they jumped up to, I think it was 300.
Wow.
And the structure for the Office of Chairman's House was literally written on the back of a napkin. It was kind of like, hey, we're going to get all this money. It went to the person who became the director. She was at the time a group chief, like a second line supervisor. And now she was being elevated to a third line supervisor. And they said, if you had anything that you wanted, what would it be? And she kind of sketched out the organization that she would look for. And they just said, okay, you got it. And so then they put out a call for volunteers across the agency. And like I said, I was already kind of looking for something to do. So I raised my hand and said, yeah, I'd like to do that. And they selected me to go over. So it was interesting because that organization had been sketched out so quickly, we soon learned that there were certain elements that we didn't need. And I happened to be on one of those branches initially. We were called the terrorist facilities branch. There were like five of us. And they were like, we're not going to have you do the camps in Afghanistan. We're already literally targeting them, doing operations against them. They had already started the air war and all the stories that you've heard about that. We want you to look elsewhere in the world and see if there are other training camps that might be like what they have in Afghanistan. And so we looked around and we wrote one paper saying we don't see any other areas in the rest of the world that have these facilities like they have in Afghanistan. And that kind of put us out of business. We wrote the paper that put us out of it because they're like, okay, well, then we don't really need you anymore. And so they kind of farmed the five of us out to other areas. For me, they put me they needed an executive assistant to the deputy director of the counterterrorism center. He's a senior intelligence service officer, actually an analyst. The deputy was an analyst. The lead guy was an operations guy. And they said, we want you to be his assistant. And we also want you to handle the congressional portfolio. And it's a 6-month rotation. But this was from February to August of 2002. And I was right in the middle of both the internal 9/11 review that CIA was conducting, and then all of the congressional questions, and then the establishment of the 9/11 commission.
Wow.
All took place kind of in that 6-month period. So that was kind of interesting to be there for that, to kind of see how that all was going on during that period.
Yeah, but by all means, what was that experience like?
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Okay, well, the fun thing about that, we had two oversight committees that look at the Central Intelligence Agency. There's the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and there's the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Same thing today. And they were demanding a weekly briefing for members, and they wanted the director of the Counterterrorism Center to provide that briefing. Well, the director at the time, Kofor Black, he's a legend in CIA and ops world. Great guy. I mean, the architect of our campaign in Afghanistan right after 9/11.
Wow.
He had no time for Congress. I mean, just to be frank, he'd be like, why am I wasting my time going and telling them I'm trying to do stuff here? I don't want to be telling them what I'm doing. I want to be actually doing it. So the few times that he went up there, and my job was to kind of put his briefing book together weekly and to prep him to go in front of these committees.
Wow.
He was almost intentionally disdainful towards them, like kind of a read from his briefing book, and they didn't really like it. The times that he refused to go, they actually tapped the deputy director of the Office of Terrorism Analysis, so the analyst guy, to go and do that. And he's a guy that you see still on CNN all the time now. His name's Phil Mudd. If you ever come across him, he's a talking head now. Great guy. Loved working with him. And because he was this analyst and was used to briefing and doing all that, they loved him. So it soon became, we don't want the director of the counterterrorism, and we want this analyst guy to come. And so that was mainly every week I would get Phil ready to go and brief them. And what was fascinating about that is that we were literally, you had to read the paper and listen to the news on your way in every day, because you knew that was what you were going to be working on that day. Hmm. That if there was some story that came up that Congress would want to know about, you know, because they were mainly driven by reading the newspaper and listening to the talking heads on TV, even back in the 02 period, that we would have to answer to that. And my favorite story to tell about that was, there was something called, you might've heard of it, it's called the Phoenix Memo. It was an FBI memo from the Phoenix field office that said there was a report that there were Arabs that were taking flight training. They wanted to learn how to take off and fly, but they didn't want to learn how to land. And so everybody, of course, that raised a bunch of issues about why didn't this get broadly disseminated? Why wasn't this passed, you know, through CIA? And the short answer was, the FBI's mission prior to 9/11 was much different than what it was post 9/11. Pre 9/11, it was to solve crimes after it had happened. Now, post 9/11, they're being told stop those crimes before they happen. And they just weren't at the time set up for that. Most of the field offices reported to the local U.S. attorney in the area. They didn't really have a way of communicating to headquarters, nor did headquarters really care like, well, that's going on in your district. Just deal with it.
Right.
So there was no real formal mechanism to pass stuff to like headquarters. And then if it had even gone to FBI headquarters, they didn't have an analytic group like we did that could have processed that information. And then the question became, well, did you share this with any to the FBI? And we used to do these briefings jointly with the FBI, the CIA and FBI together at the table. And we knew we were going to get asked, okay, FBI, did you pass that to CIA? And the answer at the time was no, they hadn't. And so the first person in CIA to get that Phoenix memo was me. Because I called over to the FBI and I said, we're going to go up in front of the Senate Subcommittee on Intelligence this afternoon. We know they're going to ask us, have you provided it? Can you send it over? And they faxed it over that day and put it in the briefing book. And we went, and sure enough, the committee left the sitting in the ante room for about an hour plus. You know, I think it was kind of their way of messaging us. And then normally there wouldn't be the full committee, all of the senators there. But today, that day there was. Like every single senator was there because it was such a pressing news story. And our part was very limited. They said, CIA, when did you get this memo? And we said, today. And then they went, thank you, FBI. And then they went all up and down the poor FBI guy. It was there the whole time. We felt very bad for him. But that was the kind of thing that we were doing, was just anytime some sensationalistic, you should have known this report came out, we had to kind of answer for it. And I mean, to be fair, in retrospect, and I know you've done other podcasts on this, we basically determined that I think the 9/11 commission put it best in their report, that 9/11 was a failure of imagination. That's the central conclusion of the 9/11 commission. And I wholeheartedly concur with that. We didn't think that terrorists could hijack a plane and fly it into a building. That was not, you know, we were just talking about, you know, mirror imaging in Western, that was not in our collective conscience. We like to point to a piece that we wrote for the President's Daily Briefing before 9/11 that cited, we thought that there was intelligence, that there was heightened alert, that Al-Qaeda was trying to do something potentially against the homeland. And we kind of had a laundry list of things that we thought they might do. And we had hijacking on there, but we had it in the traditional sense of you hijack a plane and you hold it hostage for, you know, to meet the demands. We didn't have it where they would fly into a building. And we wouldn't have known that unless we had penetrated the cell of the actual perpetrators of 9/11 or the highest levels of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, Zawahiri, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Mm-hmm. And really, they compartmented it so well that it was those three and then the cell leaders. That was it. That was all that they had. So unless we had penetrated those guys, we wouldn't have known about this. And then we didn't imagine that such a thing could happen. And that, so I fully support the conclusions of the 9/11 commission. I think in that our internal review basically said the same thing. Now, were the things that we could have done to try to penetrate those organizations? Sure. But the terrorist organization is a hard thing to penetrate.
Right, right. Obviously.
And then especially as they would learn to avoid, you know, like our technical collection, then, you know, human is really hard to do in that sense.
Right. I tell you, KSM, that's the name I haven't heard in a long time. I'd love to discuss a little bit about, our listeners should know that our mutual friend, Mike Croissant, and my former interviewee, as a matter of fact, set up this little meeting, bless his heart. And I asked him, you know, broadly speaking, what's some of the things that you and I might want to talk about that'd be of interest to our listeners. And he more or less begged me to bring up the rise and fall of Zakawi. So my understanding is that you had a front row seat for his rise, and I think you had left by the time he was killed. So,
I'm happy to get into that. That actually segues very nicely chronologically.
Brilliant.
Because in August of 2002, when my rotation to the CTC front office was up, Phil Mudd called me in and said, Jim, you did a great job on this. Where do you want to go next within the Counterterrorism Center? And I had heard Kofor Black, he was the director of CTC, as I mentioned. He had always been saying, well, Al-Qaeda is kind of second string, if you can believe it or not. Hezbollah is the A team. You know, someday we're going to go toe-to-toe with Hezbollah, and they've got Iranian support, and that's going to be Clash of the Titans. So I was like, maybe I should go work Hezbollah. That might be the next big thing. And Phil's like, no, I don't think you should do that. There's really not a whole lot going on there. They've kind of taken a lower profile post 9/11. We want you to go work. I think you should go work in our weapons of mass destruction group. And I was like, I don't know anything about weapons of mass destruction. I'm a political scientist, history guy. I don't know anything about that. He's like, don't worry about the technical side of it. We've got guys that can do that. Can you follow people? Can you identify networks? Can you do that? So I said, yeah, I can do that. They're like, okay, you should go there. So I said, sure, Phil, I trust you. I'll go over there. And so when I went over to that team, we had a team that was looking at big Al-Qaeda and some of their efforts pre-9/11, and then all of the reports post-9/11 of them potentially acquiring weapons of mass destruction. They put me on kind of the team that was not working on Al-Qaeda, but kind of everything else that was going on. And there was so Vice President Cheney at the time was convinced that the next attack on the homeland would be one using weapons of mass destruction. He just knew that that would be the case. And so he actually called the operations chief of our weapons of mass destruction department, a guy named Rolf Mollett Larsen. He's out in the public now. A great guy. He had really great backstory on him too. But he told him, he's like, if there's a 1% chance that any of the reports that you're receiving could be credible, I want you to run it down. And we were getting, you know, post 9/11, everybody's giving us threat reports, you know, and most of them were complete BS. You know, this is the way to get money from the US government. I'll tell them that there's going to be this attack and, you know, they'll pay me. And so we're getting tons and tons of non-credible reports, but we're still running down a lot of these things because the vice president told us, you got to run these things down. You know, don't have that failure of imagination, you know, run all of these things down. So one of the things that I got involved with was a group of guys that looked like they were mixing up they're trying to make rudimentary contact poison. I mean, this is like really basic stuff, like grinding up cyanide salt and mixing it with like Bengay, like a skin penetrant, and you know, hoping that they could put that on somebody. We think they were doing it because some of these guys were associated with the jihad in Chechnya that was still going on at the time. And allegedly, these guys believed it, the Russians killed Ibn al-Khattab, who was the Mujahideen leader in Chechnya. Supposedly he died by opening a poisoned letter. And, you know, that might be within the capability of the Russian state government to do something like that. But it would be a very sophisticated agent, obviously, to be able to do that. And these guys, you know, no training, no education. They're like, we need something like that. So that was what they were doing, was they're mixing this stuff up. And at the time, it wasn't a really big deal. But then all of a sudden, they supposedly killed a donkey with this stuff. Hmm. And we think that they might have done it in real life if they like shaved the donkey really crudely and like where there were cuts and stuff. And then they just lathered this stuff on the donkey, that might have worked. But all of a sudden, they're like, we got it, we got this thing. Well, of course, in the post 9/11 environment, when everybody's convinced that the next step, this was the President Bush knew these guys by name and that were doing it. And it was one guy who was in a part of Georgia that the Georgian government didn't control called the Pankisi Gorge in the north of Georgia. And that was the main route for foreigners to get into Chechnya. There's one guy that's sitting there, he's a Jordanian. He was talking to a guy in Iran who was talking to a guy in the Kurdish enclave in Iraq that was north of the northern no-fly zone. Mm-hmm. So again, beyond government control. And these guys were all talking to each other and they were all Jordanians, which was kind of interesting. And eventually a guy named Ahmed Fadl Akhlela, who became known as Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, was kind of inserted himself into all these. These guys were all tied into him. And it was really interesting to kind of watch this, because then we also got some indications that there were these North Africans who had gone, had fled North Africa, gone to Europe. And at the time, France and the UK kind of had these really weird immigration laws where they applied for asylum and they were denied asylum. They didn't think that they were qualified, but they didn't send them back because they're like, well, they might be right. And if we send them back, they'll get killed. So we'll just leave them here in this kind of quasi-legal status. So there are a number of these North Africans in both France and the UK. If you've ever heard of the Finsbury Mosque in London, that was kind of where these guys were associated with. that some of those guys then said, hey, let's go fight in Chechnya. Let's go fight the jihad over there. So they showed up. And actually, before he was killed, Ibn al-Attab said, I don't want these guys. They don't have any training. They don't have any education. They're cannon fodder. Just leave them there in the Pankisi Gorge. Don't send them into Chechnya. But one of the guys who went by the nom de guerre of Abu Atiyah, he was one of the Jordanians that was doing this stuff. He kind of came up with the idea of, hey, these guys all have European travel documents. Let's send them back to Europe and maybe we could do some sort of attack against citizens, maybe using this rudimentary contact poison that we're doing. And so that kind of reporting all got spun up. And then, of course, the guys in Iraq became of central interest to the administration because, do they have ties to Saddam Hussein? And, you know, almost immediately after 9/11, of course, you probably heard the story. We have the administration asking us, well, was Saddam Hussein tied into 9/11? And that was just a constant drumbeat to the point where we had a whole team in the counterterrorism center that did nothing but doing, when we eventually went into Iraq, all the document exploitation was looking for connections between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. And the conclusion, which was publicly made, was no, we didn't see any conclusion. And these guys were technically not associated with some. They were in the north of the no-fly zone, in an area that the government didn't control. But the administration became, you know, the magic solution there of
right,
you know, potential WMD attack, Iraq, you know, all this stuff that really got their height. And so when Secretary Powell made his speech before the United Nations making the case, they actually asked us to write a section of that talking about these Kermal was the town that they were in these connections. And so we laid it out as straight as we could. Like we said, yes, they are in Iraq, but it's in this, you know, and the administration kind of suggested that there might be more there than there was. But I think, in fact, the Iraq Review Committee afterwards, kind of the WMD Commission came back and said, you know, you stated it, you know, pretty clearly what you had and you know, didn't take any undue leaps to tie the regime into these guys. But that was how I first got onto these guys. And then, of course, when we rolled into Iraq, Zarqawi was waiting for us. We actually found copies of Secretary Powell's speech at Kermal, at the facility there.
No kidding.
Yep. They knew we were coming. I mean, we obviously telegraphed it. And then they all hid out in Fallujah and the Al-Anbar province. And of course, our strategy was to go straight to Baghdad. So we kind of left the West alone at the time. And so Zarqawi, foreseeing all of this, saw, you know, a potential that, you know, if we stay out here in the West, we can start, we'll get these guys in and then we can start doing attacks against them. And so that was March is when we invaded. By summer and fall, we're starting to see these attacks occurring. The Jordanian embassy in Iraq, the UN headquarters in Iraq, mm-hmm. you know, car bombings, various, you know, suicide attacks. And we start to get reporting that it's all tied into this guy named Musab al-Zarqawi and who had kind of fallen off the grid after Secretary Powell's speech, you know, and these guys kind of dispersed. We didn't really see the contact boys and stuff going. Wait, a number of those guys got arrested in France and the UK. So I kind of fallen off. And then we're like, hey, that's where he's been, you know, and that really gave him the advantage, though, was at the time, even though Iraq was mainly a secular culture, all of the people that were opposed to us, mainly Sunnis, kind of flocked to him because he was the only guy doing anything at the time. And so even though they weren't really thrilled with his, you know, belief in, you know, Salafism and this extreme view of Islam, they were like, well, he's the only show in town right now, so we should probably help this guy out. So we started to see Iraqis flock to him. He was bringing in, using a lot of his connections. So he had been in Afghanistan against the Soviets back in the day, and then had built a number of connections throughout. That's how he was able to kind of, you know, guys in Iraq talking to guys in Iran, talking to guys in Jordan. They just all knew each other. You know, he was able to play upon that to just really build what became ISIS eventually.
Wow. It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
I got to ask you this. So what was the code word that your circle referred to Zarqawi as over the phone?
Okay. I got to tell the story. So, Yeah, Mike probably told you. It's a great story. So when I eventually went from the weapons of mass destruction team, we were still following Zarqawi, for even though he was mainly not doing weapons of mass destruction stuff, we were still following him because no one else was. I mean, then the counterterrorism was kind of interesting. They were like, we're still trying to get Osama bin Laden. We're still focused on the Al-Qaeda threat. This is Iraq. This isn't really terrorism. We'll let the Office of Iraq Analysis deal with these guys. But then we kept saying, but these are international terrorists. These are Jordanians. These are foreigners that are doing it. And they're doing terrorist attacks. So we just kind of kept doing that. Eventually, they finally said, the CIA agreed and created a Zarqawi branch that they moved me to, along with a number of other people who have kind of been following this for a while. Two of those guys were guys that actually, when we stood up our station in Baghdad, they asked for an analytics cell to kind of support things there. And these two guys were two of the first guys to go there. And so they were there for six, I think it was a year, came back to our team, and they told me the story of one of the guys, I'll just call him Brian. We called him the slightly autistic targeter because dude knew names, knew facts, could instant recall, but was a little off. And then he was in Baghdad with my buddy Dave. And one day, Brian was about to go on leave. He got some R&R, was going to, I think, go into Europe someplace. And we had some information that a potential lead about where we might be able to find Zarqawi at a meeting or something like that. So before he left, he called Dave into the kitchen at the station and said, dude, I'm going on leave, but if we get Zarqawi, I want you to call me and to say the Eagle has new shoots. And Dave's like, what? What are you talking about? He's like, no, man, I'm serious. Because obviously we can't talk about an open phone. So if we kill him, or if we get him, I want you to call me and say, the Eagle has new shoes. And we didn't get him, of course. But that became our kind of running joke. These guys come back and we're like, yeah, so someday if we ever get him, we'll say the Eagle has new shoes. And that was kind of the running joke until the day that we actually did get him in 2006. You're right. I had just left that team in March. I got a management job back in my old weapons of mass destruction group, still doing Iraq related stuff. But by this point, looking at what ISIS was doing with like chlorine bombs and things like that. But I was sitting home after work, it was like 6 PM. And one of my other buddies from the team, the old team, called me and he said, hey, Jim, we went shopping today and the Eagle has new shoes. And I'm like, what? What? Oh, it's like, yeah. A bunch of the old guys from the team are coming in. We're going to look through it and write something up. Do you want to come in? It's like, no, you guys have got this. I'm not on the team anymore. I got my other team I got to worry about, but thank you for letting me know. And after I hung up, I realized that the problem with the code phrase was that it didn't differentiate between killed or captured. And so I was like, do we kill him? Do we capture him? What it was? Well, then another friend of mine, Jen, she and I had been working Zarqawi the longest between the two. She was back pre-Iraq invasion days. And she had this great Southern accent. I think she was from Tennessee. And she goes, Jim, the Eagle has new shoes. And I was like, I know. Mike just called me. Is the Eagle still with us? And she goes, no, he's not. And it's definitely him. I saw the photos. And that was great because, because we had been chasing him for 4 years at that point, we kind of sat back and just thought about how great it was that, we had, not to revel in the death of a human being, but, this is a bad dude that we had been chasing a long time and had really frustrated us and done a lot of damage. And, it just felt like a real sense of, I say it's the highlight of my career, always, that day, especially. After that, I got off the phone with her and I don't know if Google was even around in 06, whatever the search engine was at the time, but I put it in and they hadn't released it yet that they had killed him. So I couldn't say anything. I couldn't tell my wife, I couldn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
So I go to bed. Next morning I get up. I see overnight the coalition authority had released that they had killed him. So I kind of shook my wife awake and said, hey, we killed Zarqawi last night. She's like, yeah, that's great, honey. I'm like, I'm about to sleep. So drive in, but as soon as I get into work, login, instant messaging just popping up everywhere, and just people I hadn't talked to in years but we had worked the target at one point, just, hey, we got him, finally got him, couple of the ops guys that I'd worked with originally, you know, big bear hugs. It was just a great day. Got home that night and I found out my wife was paying attention, because when I drove home, my kids had got and put in sidewalk chalk all over our driveway. Rest in peace, Sarkawi, you know, USA, USA, all this stuff. So I was like, if my neighbors didn't know what I worked on, they did at that point. So that was just kind of cool that they got to kind of share in that. They were real little at the time, but yeah, it was kind of cool to kind of revel in that as well. And like I said, that's kind of the highlight of my career. That day.
That's fantastic, man. That's a great story. I love it. Yeah. I'm so glad I asked that question.
Yeah, I like to tell that story.
Yeah, absolutely. So when and why did you leave the agency?
That's a good question. So I ended up working in the Counterterrorism Center from October of 9/11 or 2001 through the end of December of 2008. And so that was a long time to be working counterterrorism, just the operational tempo, the subject matter. One of the things I had to do was I had to watch those beheading videos that ISIS was putting out.
Daniel Pearl.
These were even the guys in Iraq that they were getting. And you know, so we'd have to watch it over and over, because we're looking at it analytically, right? Any identification about who these people are and where they might be? Is it really the guy that they said that it is, that they were beheading? So that kind of got to you after a while, you know, just a sense of responsibility for when an attack occurred. You know, what could I have done more to stop that? The agency, actually, to its credit, gave a lot of good help on that and to kind of help us walk through that. So we tend to think that we can control all this stuff, and you know, it helps to have an objective third party go, and what more could you have done? You know, could you have written a cable that would have stopped that from happening? No, probably not. You know, it's you have to kind of deal with that and let go of some of that false sense of responsibility for some of the things that have happened. So I was kind of ready to take a break. I actually did a wonderful tour. It's actually one of my favorite tours as a leadership and management instructor. CIA has CIA University, which is in-house training for all CIA members, but then each directorate, it's now the director of analysis, that when I was there as the director of intelligence, had their own Sherman Kent School for Intelligence Analysis. And they had the guys that would teach the tradecraft that I talked about, but then they also had people that would teach leadership and management, which I'm very passionate about. And so I did that for 2.5 years. I taught the course for new first-line supervisors, new team chiefs. And then I taught crisis management, given my background. And then I taught strategic planning, which was something I acquired kind of there, and was a big proponent of it now. But even that was kind of a 2 to 3 year rotation. Didn't quite feel comfortable getting back on the line at that point. My dad was born here in Omaha, and I'd always enjoyed coming here to the Midwest. My wife's from Northern Illinois. Every time we would visit her family, it just kind of, the Midwest kind of felt nice. You know, I grew up on the West Coast, lived on the East Coast.
Right.
Wanted to see kind of what the Midwest was like. And so one of the CIA rep positions to U.S. Strategic Command came open, and I applied for it and was accepted. And so came out here with the idea of, well, we got 2 to 3 years on this rotation to see if we like Nebraska. And if we do, then maybe we get out and stay here in the Midwest. Or if we don't, you know, we can always go back. But the more we were out here in the Midwest, you know, my commute in D.C. was 1 hour and 10 minutes one way. You know, 12-hour days, then plus right. The commute. But I had 4 kids at that time. We ended up having another one while we were here in Nebraska before I got done. Enjoyed having the family time. And just the idea of going back, and it's not like the military where you put in 20 years and you can retire. I'd done 15, but I had another 18 until I hit 65 and could retire at that point. And I kind of used up as an analyst, you kind of get 2 rotations where you can go outside in the DC area. And I just used up one of them. So most of my time would have been back in the DC area. And I just didn't really want to do that. So began looking for options here in Nebraska. And actually a friend of a friend said, hey, I work for a health system here called Nebraska Medicine. We're always looking for smart people. Do you want to come and work here? It's very similar to the conversation I had with Phil Mudd. I don't know anything about healthcare. Like, don't worry about it. We got guys who do that. You know, we're looking for smart guys, and you've management experience, you know, working in the CIA, you want to come work here? And I said, sure. So I ended up leading the project management office for 4 years and in 5.5 years total, I did some work. But then even then I was kind of fish out of water in the healthcare system. So another friend hooked me up with a contracting agency to go back to StratCom. And yeah, so now I'm back in the familiar confines of the government.
That's awesome.
I speak the language a little bit better.
That's interesting. So yeah, just a little about me before getting into podcasting and writing, and that I was actually an IT executive. I was a project manager. Agile, well, Scrum.
I loved managing project managers, man. It's the greatest gig in the world because they're project managers. They manage themselves. So as long as I'm kind of empowering them, getting the tools that they needed and letting them go, they were very easy to me. I loved that job. That was a fun job.
They all say, I'll get back to you. You know, that
never
whole
say
thing.
No.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I had some great project managers and did a lot of great work. Nebraska Medicine, I loved actually working for them. They're a great healthcare organization here in Nebraska. And we did some really cool stuff there. So that's just a weird turn in my career. And I still don't fully understand why I was there, what the purpose of me being there. It was an opportunity at the time, but maybe someday I'll figure out why I did that little diversion in my life.
I love it. Perfect. Good grief. Time flies, doesn't it?
Yes.
So we'll close it out here. Jim Horacek, how can people find out about you, sir?
You can find me on LinkedIn. Jim Horacek, I've got some of my background. I even threw some photos up there from my time in the agency. So if you want to see me when I was a little bit heavier, one of the downsides of working counterterrorism is you don't exercise and you don't eat right. So, but you know, see my GS-15 promotion ceremony there. I got a picture there when I got that with Mike Morrell, who's infamous now, and some of the other stuff. I'm on Twitter. I don't really tweet too much except about the LA Dodgers, which is my real passion in life is baseball. And your contact information is there if you want it. Anybody wants to message me.
Excellent, Jim. This was a pleasure. Thank you so much for doing this, man.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. It makes me feel like I sort of did something in my life.
Perfect, man. Well, you take care.
Okay. Thanks, Josh. I appreciate it.
Yep. Bye, Jim.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.